Welcome to RevDem. My name is Vera Stepanovic. I'm the section head for political economy here at the Review of Democracy. And today I have the great pleasure to host Helen Thompson. Helen is a professor of political economy at Cambridge and is well known to political economy buffs for her work on the politics of debt and transnational finance and the geopolitics of energy. But Helen is also an active public intellectual who has co-hosted for years the Talking Politics podcast and contributes regular columns to the New Statesman. Today, we are talking about her great new book, Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. Welcome to the Review of Democracy, Helen.
It's a pleasure to be, absolute pleasure to be here.
Lovely to have you. Disorder is a refreshingly ambitious book. You do not shy away from embracing complexity. You're trying to understand how we got here, where here is an intersection of overlapping complicated crises. And so the first challenge is actually to parse out what these crises are, right? To identify the key fault lines and separate the structural from the ephemeral. And the way you do this is by focusing on three major fault lines. The first is the geopolitics of energy, the geopolitical jostling that emerges in the wake of China's economic rise and the changing competition for energy sources, especially oil and gas. The second is the complicated politics of transnational finance and debt, especially the fact that the US dollar remains the reserve currency of the world, whereas the US itself seems to be losing primacy in some other ways, technological, political, perhaps even military. And the third is a political crisis. And this is quite, you have a very nice way of describing it, because I think we have talked about it as this deep sense of malaise over populism and the eruption of populist nationalism. But sort of the more deeper issue seems to be the general, more broader erosion of authority of democratic institutions. So is this a fair way to describe what you mean by disorder, or have the more recent developments changed your appraisal of what are the most important structural issues?
This is quite a complicated question, Vera, because originally I intended the book to have four parts. I intended to have a fourth section about the cultural and religious fault lines in Europe in particular. And the framing of that was going to be the rise of civilizational rhetoric in all in different ways of Russia, Hungary, and France, and the way that that mapped onto long-standing issues around the formation of territorial states and empires where Russia is concerned in Europe. And so I think that what's happened in Russia's war in Ukraine has actually brought that issue in the way in which Putin in particular thinks about the old Russian Empire and its relationship to his idea of Russia as a civilizational state, like very much to the fore. So although I think that in my story about geopolitics, I've got a quite, you know, sort of an explanation about how Europe in some sense got to this point in dealing with Russia, i.e. not taking seriously the security needs of the independent state standing between Germany and Russia, plus the European energy dependency on Russia, I don't think I've got an explanation as to why Putin's pursued the kind of war in which he has. But in some sense, I think I would have had an explanation if I had stuck with my original idea of trying to tell four stories. Now, the reason why I pulled back from the fourth story was because I realized that it was just going to be much more difficult to tie all the different bits together and to pull out the interactive relationships in the way in which I try to do now between the geopolitical, the economic and transnational finance, as you say, and democratic and politics. It perhaps would have been possible, but I don't think it would have. I would have to have taken quite a bit longer to write the book in order to do that. And as you said, it's already quite a complicated book, you know, as it is. So I want to say that we can't actually understand the disorder, though, without that missing part too, because I don't think that we could explain on pure, if you like, energy realist grounds why Putin would order the kind of invasion of Ukraine that he has. I think that to say that, you know, he did it to secure Ukraine as an energy sphere of influence for Russia and to deal with Russia's pipeline problems, I don't think that is a sufficient explanation of what's gone on at all.
Right. It's interesting that you say that, because the first part of the book deals with energy, and in a sense, it is very much about how the post-war Western world has been anchored in this particular material structure, our dependence on fossil fuels and oil and gas in particular. But at the same time, it is precisely not this crude explanation of how energy determines politics. It is a much more complex retelling of the story of how our political engagements have been reshuffled around this complicated politics of energy geopolitics. And I found this very new. I mean, in a sense, it should be obvious that our civilization runs on fossil fuels. We've been having conversations about it. But somehow it is not. Perhaps it is so fundamental that precisely it fades into the background. I think, for example, how I talk to my students and how we tell the story of our own time. So, you know, let's call it neoliberal era for lack of a better word. It starts with a big oil crisis, which break the post-war social compact. And then the Western states are pushed in a different direction of economic and political development. But then, even though we know that it starts with this oil crisis, then the oil recedes into the background, and we don't really come back to this. And your book really pulls it back center stage. And in doing so, it unearths so many connections, which I found illuminating. So for instance, the fact that two out of the three economic powerhouses in the world are completely dependent, don't have domestic sources of oil and gas, China and the EU, and the third one, the US, shifts between being an exporter and an importer over time, and that of course completely reshapes their international economic connections. And also, for example, the story about how we would have had a secular oil induced inflation because of the growing demand in China, had China at the same time not reduced inflation by pushing down the prices of manufactured goods. So these are the kinds of connections that I think you don't see much in how we talk about international political economy, and which I found that they completely changed my perspective. Have you had those moments of, now I understand better how things connect? Or what surprised you the most as you were unraveling the story of oil?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. If I go back a bit, so when I first started working on oil, I actually started writing the book, a short book I wrote about oil. I began writing that in 2015. And I'd been thinking about oil, I would say, seriously in 2013, 14. What struck me then was that I was trying at that point to try to bring oil into the stories that I knew better, which were the monetary and financial stories, and particularly about the financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis. And I was aware, I think, I sort of started dwelling on the relationship between the monetary environment that was created by the crash and the Federal Reserve Board's response to the crash and the American shale oil boom, and seeing that actually that the monetary environment was a necessary condition of the shale oil boom. So that was my real point of entry, because I could see that the shale oil boom mattered, and I could see through the thing that I did know something about, the monetary side, that there was a connection between the two. So that was my entire starting place, I think, for going down the road in which I've ended up making energy so central to what I think about. And in some sense, my first aha moment was when I was trying to think of a way of incorporating oil into the book that I then wanted to write about the financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis. And the oil just seemed to get bigger and bigger to the point when the conjunction of the fact that circumstances in Cambridge meant that I wasn't going to be able to take the leave that I thought I was going to, and couldn't write a longer book and needed to write a short book. I just thought, you know what, Helen, just write a book about oil. That actually oil just got bigger and bigger in the way in which I was framing things, that instead of trying to fit it in, I decided actually just start there and then the other things come into it rather than the other way around. If we move on to then when I was writing Disorder, I think that where oil was concerned, I had a big aha moment about the Suez Crisis. And when I was doing that part, that second chapter of the geopolitical part of the book, and I'd written a long essay, which was the basis of me working the whole argument out initially, including when it had this more ambitious fourth part about the civilizational rhetoric in Europe. And Sirius was a part of that story, but it was only when I was really trying to write that section that it suddenly dawned on me that actually it was such a pivotal moment, and that actually there was a story to be told backwards from Suez about the relationship between Germany and Russia in particular where energy was concerned, and a story to be told forward about how the Russian-European in general energy relationship and the Russian-German energy relationship in particular had followed from that moment on, even though we were obviously that point. It's serious talking about the Soviet Union and not about Russia. So the point in which I decided to make Suez the pivot, if you like, of my second geopolitical chapter was quite an aha moment, because the more I kept thinking about it, the more I thought, yeah, this does work as a way of essentially of structuring that chapter. And then I realized when I was actually onto the 2010s and was thinking about the Syrian crisis in the September 2013 Syrian crisis, when Obama pulls back from his red line about the chemical weapons. And I realized there were certain parallels to be drawn at that moment with the Suez Crisis in terms of being a watershed, again, around Anglo-American-French relations. And seeing that, I was a bit taken aback. And obviously the danger with this stuff is that you start seeing patterns where they're not. And you have to sort of pull back from that and try and convince yourself that they really are there, and that they're not just ones that you've now become oversensitive to and can see whether they don't actually exist. But I think this series story is pretty important. And I think that particularly as somebody who's British and who, you know, grew up with this idea, and it was kind of, you know, there in lots of the ways in which I was taught about, you know, British foreign policy, for instance, at university, that Suez is just this humiliating moment for Britain where the British political class has to wake up to its imperial hubris and realise in some sense that British imperial power doesn't matter, couldn't matter in the middle of the 20th century. I just think that's a completely misleading interpretation of what happened. That isn't to make some moral defence of the British Empire in the Middle East in all this. It's simply to see that the British imperial presence in the Middle East was supposed to serve a function for Western Europe's energy security in the post-Second World War world. And there were, in energy terms, good reasons for that. It was supposed to be the American position that was necessary, because the Americans didn't want to do that role themselves. And so when it falls apart, the whole assumption on which, in many ways, I would say, you know, like post-war Western European economic recovery after the Second World War rests upon, is just yanked away. And it's not surprising then that there's so many consequences that in some sense we're still living with now, not least the energy relationship with Russia that follow from what happened in October, November 1956.
Oh, absolutely. That was the chapter that that made me laugh darkly, because as if we follow the news, we are now more than a month into the invasion, and there is mounting public pressure to say we need to break this European Union's dependence on Russian oil and gas, and we need to find some other way to. We need to stop funding this war effectively, because this connection is still there. And to realize to what extent, in the way you tell the story, this dependence on Russia is in itself the result of previous attempts to break inadmissible dependencies on other unreliable parts of the world, to diversify. So in light of all that full history of these previous realignments, how do you see these prospects? Now, the European Commission has been promising to cut dependence on Russia by, I don't know, the end of this year, by 2030. How do you see the prospects of this relationship changing?
I mean, I'd say several things here. First of all, is that I think it's going to be pretty difficult for European countries to reduce radically their dependence on Russian gas in particular. I think one of the reasons for that is that over the last few years, we've been seeing a China gas shock in the way in which there was a China oil shock in the middle of the 2000s. So China's demand for gas imports, natural gas imports, rose 20% in 2021. And this means that if the European countries that are particularly dependent on pipelined gas from Russia, obviously most importantly Germany, are over the next few years going to move to the liquid natural gas market, there's going to be absolutely intense competition for that supply. Unless we're going to say that actually, quite quickly, China is going to stop being in the liquid natural gas market for any such exports except from Russia. And that, as well, a second pipeline from Russia to China, gas pipeline, a second Power-Siberia pipeline is going to be built rapidly. Then that's the nature of the competition that now exists. And we can see if we go back to last autumn before the invasion, this competition was already causing both China and other Asian countries and European countries, very severe difficulties. At certain points, there's about the gas that European countries are paying for the United States is about 10, at least 10 times more expensive than the gas that's being provided domestically into the American market. And we see for the first time in December 2021, so December last year, instead of ships carrying liquid natural gas that are supposedly heading for Europe, heading off to Asia because the prices are more expensive in Asia, for the first time it goes the other way around because European demand is for it is so high, and prices in Europe, the European prices are so much higher than Asian prices, or significantly higher than Asian prices. We've got ships, bound for Asia that then turning around and going to some European port. And this is all before we even get to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the fact that supposedly the European countries over the next 4 or 5 years are going to turn away entirely from Russian gas. I think the other thing that's really interesting, though, here is we can see some of the same dynamics in terms of alternatives at play now as they were after Suez. So, if you say what were the other two, the big two alternatives that were pursued after Suez, the first was nuclear power, and including in West Germany, we can see again a turn back to nuclear power. I mean, maybe some of the same problems that stopped anyone really, other than the French, pursuing the nuclear power option so systematically will come back into play. It is expensive. And the other option, and this one's really interesting, I think, is the French position after Suez, which was to say, actually, The future where our oil interests are concerned lies with Algeria and the absolute commitment of the then French government that Algeria was going to be part of the European Economic Community, Algeria still being a French colony, obviously, at that point. And the idea there was is that Algeria would be able to sell its oil and later gas into what would be, you know, the European Economic Community's unified market. And that doesn't really work out because the French aren't able to hold on to their position in Algeria, and Algeria becomes an independent country. But if we look at the alternatives that are now being talked up on the gas side, one of them is Algeria. And what is, again, though, interesting is that this can't just be done on European terms, because the Algeria is already a big supplier to Spain and Italy. And the Algerian government is now very unhappy about the position that Spain's taken on the conflict between Algeria and Morocco over Western Sahara. So you can get out of one set of problems with Russia, just like you could get out of one set of problems in Syria, or at least minimize the problems in Syria, but you will get yourself into another set of problems. And the same will be just as true if the answer becomes the East Mediterranean and the East Mediterranean gas there, because that involves really difficult questions about Turkey, the fact that Turkey's been essentially kept out of the gas projects in the Eastern Mediterranean. It also brings into play Israel as a question for European Union countries to deal with. So the nature of the distribution of oil and gas in Eurasia and the places in which it's concentrated means that there isn't any way of avoiding, you know, like geopolitical difficulties. Now, I'm not saying that because I think that European Union countries should then simply accept their gas dependency upon Russia, given what's happened. I just think there has to be some realism about what plausible alternatives there are. And I know this sounds a very simple thing to say, but I don't think it's always taken on board. You can only import gas from countries where there is gas.
Right. And of course, this then begs the question of the new energy sources. And I know that you have a very realistic take on those as well. And another thing that came at me when I was reading the book, which I also didn't think about before, is the story you tell about how the very primacy of oil arose as a consequence of changes in military technology, and that perhaps it is even in that realm, it is even more difficult to make a quick shift than it would be in, I don't know, household energy consumption or something like that. I just recently read an account of somebody from the US military explaining why you cannot give certain weapons to Ukraine, because the oil consumption of these tanks and carriers is just enormous and it would not be possible to operate them. So I, of course, you know, we are very eager, and we are often thinking of, or some of us were hoping that this conflict might force the European Union towards a more investment in energy transition, but there are serious obstacles there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you wanted to push analogy, I wouldn't push this analogy too far, but, you know, it may not be a coincidence that the resurgence of interest in nuclear power goes hand in hand with, you know, like nuclear powered submarines. And they, I mean, you could see the importance of that to the Australian government when it came to the AUKUS, you know, deal and the contest with France around that last year. And I think that if we look at the domestic economy side of the energy transition, and particularly look at electric vehicles and look at the fear that in many ways China's position and relative success in the electric vehicles market has driven in Washington in particular, I think it is because there is an understanding that if your companies are going to dominate in these new markets, that does have geopolitical implications. So, you know, it wasn't just the case that the United States or that the British could see that the United States might be on a path to an oil-based navy and that they bred a do something about that and get ahead of that. It was the way in which American car companies, obviously particularly Henry Ford's car company, came to dominate the car market in the first part of the 20th century, and could get into the mass production of cars, mass car ownership as part of consumer society. I think that they were things that, you know, did incite fear inside Europe. It wasn't evident to begin with that cars was going to be a sector that was dominated by American producers, but that's the way in which it became. And at the same time, you might say, when West German and Japanese car manufacturers started to challenge American car manufacturers, that was an important moment in the story of the world economy during the 20th century.
That's where I would have liked to take this conversation next, because the way the book is structured, obviously the story of oil and energy and geopolitics structures some of these economic relations, but there is obviously much more to it. And one thing that I did find striking was the parallel between the geopolitics of energy and the transnational finance in sort of deep sense of frustration with this mutual dependence. So in the way that the explosion of capital mobility and the transnational capital markets is tying the hands or constraining economic choices of many countries, including the largest players. And there is this, on the one hand, worry in the United States about their export competitiveness that is sort of being affected by the vast reserves and the and credits that is growing in other parts of the world, and the difficulty that the Federal Reserve has in influencing domestic monetary policy because of this vast offshore dollar credit market, and then at the same time the deep unease and frustration of the European and the Chinese side with the fact that they depend on this US currency, and that even the fractional shifts in the interest rates there will wreak havoc by causing major capital shifts. And that is sort of parallel in the story of oil, right? With the way that the US is the one that provides security for the oil reserves in the Middle East, and with the Europeans and especially the Chinese at the same time being worried about this or concerned about the outsized US influence because of it. Now, one thing that really struck me was that there is this enormous dependence. There is this deep frustration on all sides with this mutual dependence. And at the same time, there seems to be very little appetite for any kind of negotiated international solution, creating any kind of international institution that might somehow share the costs of providing these essentially international public goods. Is that also how you see the situation? Or historically speaking, what are the conditions that might give rise to this kind of cooperation?
Yeah, I think that where energy is concerned, there isn't really been any attempt ever to try to internationalize the problem. There was some attempt to establish some more formalized Anglo-American cooperation during the course of the Second World War, that would have, in some sense, been a kind of parallel to Bretton Woods, but it certainly was really about Britain and the United States. It wasn't going to include all the sort of number of countries that would participate in the Bretton Woods system. And I think the bottom line there is simply that governments in individual states are so concerned about looking after their own interests, they tend to see it in such a zero-sum way that it's not possible to structure international cooperation around it. I think the slight qualification you might say to that is, but it's obviously not a formal international agreement, is there is a tacit assumption that shared in European capitals and in Washington and Beijing, probably in India, as well, and Japan certainly, that ultimately still the American Navy will be responsible for providing energy security for everybody from piracy in the in the Persian Gulf. That is not spelled out in some kind of agreement, but I don't think that there's any evidence that China actually wants the Chinese Navy to be doing that, even though much more of the oil that's coming out to the Persian Gulf these days is going to Japan and China than is going to the United States. And I don't think there's any evidence that in Washington they really want the Chinese Navy taking responsibility for that, however much protesting over Twitter Donald Trump did from time to time about other countries free riding on what the American Navy does in the Persian Gulf. When it comes to the international financial monetary side of it, obviously there is this period of international cooperation. At least it can be cast like that in a general sense, through the Bretton Woods era. But I think certain caveats have even then got to be put on that as a multilateral approach to the problem of international monetary and financial coordination. Now, first of all, the original agreement to set it up was a wartime agreement between the principal allies against Germany and Japan in the Second World War, so the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union, and that was completely geopolitically upended by the beginning of the Cold War, because the Soviet Union took itself out of, Stalin refused to ratify the Bretton Woods Agreement. And then once the Americans had moved to the position of wanting to reconstruct West Germany as it had then become, and Japan, they needed to be brought into that system. And at the same time, if you look at it, I think in straightforward monetary and financial terms, sure, there were some cooperative elements to it, but at its center, it was a dollar standard. It said that the United States had the dominant currency in the world. It was the only currency that was going to be backed by gold. Everybody else had to peg themselves around it. And a pretty strong American motive for the Bretton Woods system was that it allowed the Americans to control whether other governments could devalue their currencies against the United States. And the fact that other governments had wanted to do that and succeeded in doing that in the early 1930s was part of deep American frustration with the way in which the gold standard had ended up. So I think at times, excessively liberal interpretation is put on the Bretton Woods period as a era of multilateral cooperation. Now, if we say, is there any possibility of resurrecting that? Clearly, in today's world, it would depend upon China's participation and an agreement at its center between the United States and China. And I think that it's pretty difficult to see, where exchange rates in particular are concerned, how that would come about. Now, beyond, I think, what had gone on during the Bretton Woods era, there's a question of the euro dollar system. Although it began in the Bretton Woods era, I wouldn't say that there was anything like the same international dollar credit environment that there is today. And that does, I think, that this world in which we live financially does involve the need for tacit cooperation, sometimes more than tacit, between the world's leading central banks. And that would include, I would say, the Federal Reserve and the Chinese Central Bank. And I think it is notable in the March 2020 financial crisis that the Fed indirectly extended credit facilities to the Chinese Central Bank. It didn't offer a dollar swap line, as in some sense American allies get, but clearly the Federal Reserve provided some protection for China if the going had got really tough in terms of dollar shortage in March 2020. So in one sense, I would say where the euro dollar system is concerned is that there has to be more, as I say, at least tacit cooperation. It hasn't been subject to the same geopolitical dynamics where US-China is concerned as other areas of the world economy are, including energy. because the consequences of simply allowing a Chinese dollar crash effectively, and so many and Chinese banks, Chinese corporations being unable to deal with their dollar debt, I think that everybody agrees that they don't really bear thinking about. So in that sense, is it a system? I don't know, but some kind of quasi system, I think, is being managed, because there isn't actually any alternative to that given the stakes.
Right. I suppose it is somewhat reassuring that even under conditions of disorder, there are ways to cooperate. But there is an interesting aspect to this, which is the domestic constraints that these power might be facing in these attempts to cooperate and to keep the system relatively stable. And that is also partly the subject of the last part of your book. Mm. And of course, part of the story is about how dependence on oil and the capital markets, international capital markets, constrain political choices of the Western government and undermine perhaps democratic accountability. But a second part of it, and I found very original and very interesting, is about how politics itself has deeper structures that determine these developments, and partly might also constrain choices then in relation to international economics and the geopolitical choices. And these structures in the modern sort of democratic states, that the two key ones you identify are the tension between democracy and nationhood, and also the dynamics around debts, which is pervasive in any political system, but perhaps even more so in democratic systems. And the claim here is that with time, the accumulation of tensions along these two axes comes to a head to sort of create a crisis within democracy itself. Can you say a bit about how these tensions are limiting now the ability of Western representative democracies to reinvent themselves, or maybe even reinvent the international system with it?
I think that there's a set of questions about nationhood and democracy's need for nationhood that exist independently of the debt questions. And you know, at the center of that, I would say, is the need for losers' consent in a democracy, and the fact that actually, you know, in the history of representative democracies, that there hasn't really been an alternative to nationhood doing that work, in the sense that citizens are willing, when they are, to accept that another group of citizens' interests prevail over theirs, or beliefs or interests prevail over theirs, because ultimately they've got enough in common that they're willing to lose at least temporarily to those people. And so accept that in time that they will be on the winning side and not on the losing side, and that they are permanent losers, that in the end is not absolutely unacceptable, to the point where you don't want to be part of the same state as the people who you're losing to. And I think that American democracy in particular has suffered as the problems around nationhood have magnified for a set of complex reasons, I think, in the United States. And we can identify the fraying of losers' consent in American politics, I would say, probably since the 1990s. Now, this debt question is really interesting, and I think I could have pushed one aspect of what I was saying here further, I realised after I finished the book, and that is this, that for quite some time, including people who thought really quite hard about the relationship between emerging representative democracy in the 19th century and debt, there was an idea that actually, if you made the citizens the creditors of the state, then that they had a stake in debt being repaid. And if you say, well, why did people think that that was important? I would say because they took from the history of democracies in the ancient world, and well, actually the history of ancient Athens, Athenian democracy, and the history of the Roman Republic, that debt was a destabilizing issue in democratic or republican politics. Indeed, if you go back to the sort of the take on what Athenian democracy was like, you know, the in some ways the imaginative story that came out of it, at least as it was interpreted by many in Europe, was that to have a democracy was to be pro debtors and against creditors. I mean, that's a, you know, simplified, but there's some truth to that, I think. And so once we move in the 19th century, or we can see clearly in the 19th century, these moves to representative democracy on restricted franchise, in some sense, the idea is you give the votes to those people who will act as the creditors of the new democracies. Now, when you get to the point in the 20th century in Europe where that means everybody, we're talking about like universal franchise, then we see this idea that actually everybody is going to be a creditor to the state, a creditor citizen, to use the language that James MacDonald uses in his book on this subject. And that is part, not the only part, but it's part of how, you know, like countries like the United States and Britain finance the world wars. And they sell bonds to their citizens, and they present it as the patriotic duty of citizens to hold that debt for the country as it engages, in Britain's case, in a battle for its survival. And something of that, I think, then endures through the post-war era, meaning until the 1970s. And this is particularly through national savings accounts. And this is a period in which governments in Western democracies don't want to run budget deficits. They don't want to borrow in international financial markets. And international financial markets are in many ways restricted by the capital controls that governments have in place, and that they're allowed to have in place as a part of the Bretton Woods system. So then when governments in the 1970s do want to run large budget deficits, and they do turn back to international capital markets in order to finance their debt, something is being severed, I would say, in democratic politics, in Western democratic politics anyway, when the citizen creditor is being taken out of the picture. So it's no longer the savings and taxes of the citizens who are paying for the democratic state. A significant part of what the democratic state wants to spend money on is being borrowed in international financial markets. And in that sense, I don't think it's really a coincidence that the political problems around nationhood begin, perhaps particularly in the United States, in the 1970s, in terms of the weakening of an idea of America, of shared American nationhood. Now, there's a lot more going on in the United States case than just that, I realise that. But if we then skip on to 2008, I know this is quite a convoluted way of getting there, but we skip on to 2008, we then have a situation in which it's not the debt of the citizens that's really problematic for democratic states, although the debt of mortgage holders is pretty problematic in the United States in particular. But the debt that terrifies them isn't the debt of the citizens, it's the debt of the banks. It's the borrowing, the huge borrowing that banks have done in short-term money markets. And in the case of the European countries, that their banks have done in a foreign currency, i.e. in dollars, in short-term money markets. So we have debt as a central feature of the 2008 crisis, but the response to that problem has to be not only central banks, national central banks, basically bailing banks out, but actually in the case of European countries like Britain and France and Germany, having another country's central bank, the Federal Reserve, providing the necessary support for their banks' debts. So we've moved from a situation in which representative democratic politicians worry about debt, but they worry about, in some sense, the relationship of their citizens to debt, and then whether their citizens will be able and willing to support the state's debt. And now they're having to be obsessed, preoccupied with whether central banks can deal with the problem of internationalized bank debt. And unsurprisingly, when citizens in these democracies see the preoccupation with banks' debt and the indifference to their household debt, particularly in the United States, where you had a big foreclosures crisis, mortgage foreclosures crisis going on, this is a pretty significant political problem. But the nature, I would say, of the international financial system and the way in which the international dollar credit environment functioned meant, in some sense, there was no alternative to that without there being a pretty significant economic collapse of a kind that no democratically elected government would have any interest in happening. But I think that that's quite a change in the history as a representative democracies, when you have to have central banks being the ones who are responsible for debt problems, and the responsibility that they're focusing on is the debt problems of banks.
Right. Yeah, that is indeed a radical change in the nature of this. Now, your book is about the crisis of the largely Western representative democracies and the post-war Western order, and the disorder that is thrown into partly through this accumulation of domestic excesses and partly through the shifts of the geopolitical shifts of having to accommodate China. But what I was curious, especially when I was reading this part about democracy, is how you explain how this refounds the social contract, the relationship between the democracy, the democratic and the aristocratic tendencies within the representative democracy. And I was wondering, coming from a country that was made in 2006, living in a kind of European Union that is trying to create somehow itself as we speak, or not really, we're not yet sure, how this impacts the notions of citizenships and the notions of democracy in other places, where all of this is a given. The international capital markets are a given, and this kind of this relationship to it. I was deeply struck by your observation when you were commenting on the EU's resilience and recovery facility, about how proudly the EU officials have announced that this will have no consequences for the citizens in terms of debt and taxes, right? We will sort our this great foundation of the new deal, right, of the European Union through the international capital markets.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the point that I was saying in the last question about the importance of debt in understanding the history of representative democracies. And when you see that, then this statement that was made about the EU recovery fund, no European citizen is going to be, European Union citizen is going to be taxed anything for this. You see how odd that seems. And it really is putting the European Union in a different kind of world from the ones in which representative democracy first emerged. Now, you can say, well, that is because, the European Union isn't primarily interested in creating a democratic European Union. It's primarily interested in managing a set of economic interdependences and perhaps geopolitical now interdependences within Europe, and in terms of Europe's geopolitical relations with the rest of the world. But I still would say that that has consequences then for the ways in which any European Union citizen is going to be willing to make sacrifices in the name of shared citizenship, because the way in which that has historically been done did require some sense of shared obligations as well as shared rights. Obviously, those shared obligations weren't just about paying taxes and bearing debt, they were also about conscription But paying taxes and sharing debt was part of what it meant to be a citizen for a long time in a representative democracy. If we move to the rest of the world, I think that what's really interesting, and we can see this playing out at the moment, is the ways in relation to the war. I mean, in the relation is the ways in which Europe also provides shocks to the rest of the world. So if we think about what's happening with the war in Ukraine, you know, we've had a fundamental inability in European countries to take the problem of Russia seriously, to understand what it meant for there to be an independent Ukrainian state and to guarantee the independence, the security of that independent Ukrainian state. And as a result of that conjunction of Putin's ambition and European failure, a war is going on that is acting as a profound economic shock across the world, particularly, I would say, to certain North African and Middle Eastern countries that are particularly dependent on wheat exports from both Russia and Ukraine. And these are places, and I would pick out particularly Lebanon, but also Iraq, where we could already see back in 2019, so before the pandemic hit, that the series of geopolitical and economic problems that were writ large across the world economy were having some devastating impacts in these places. I think that, you know, it is notable that most non-Western countries are not being particularly, shall we say, judgmental about Russia's behaviour in this war. And I think if you go back to the energy side, and you just take, you know, like one example, there's, you know, like a pretty significant offshore gas project of Gazprom's, in which there were part in which Gazprom was in partnership both with Shell and with two Japanese companies, and that this Sakhalin 2, it's called, is the major Russian gas field where from which there are liquid natural gas exports rather than it being pipelined gas. Shell has announced that it's giving up its equity partnership with Gazprom, but the two Japanese companies said that they're staying, and the Japanese Prime Minister asked about it, basically said it was essential for Japan's energy security. And I think the danger in Europe at the moment is that we forget that other countries have got energy security interests too, that they don't have the same set of security concerns in relation to Russia that we do in Europe, and that they will make very different judgments than ours about what should be prioritised at this time. And that will have implications then back for European countries. So in some sense, the shocks can come out from Europe, and then they come back into Europe too. And although that I decided that I couldn't write a book that tried to also to get to grips with the issues of democracies and the economies of non-Western countries, I didn't, in making that choice, want to say that these aren't a very important part of the world in which we live and the ways in which the dysfunctional dynamics of the world in which we live work, because they very much are.
The book does touch upon the ways in which sometimes these places, which are somewhat even peripheral to the major fault lines, can become major sides of the crisis crash together. You talk about Syria quite a lot about, you know, being a sort of the very interstices of these conflicts. But it seems like you're suggesting that perhaps this Western disorder or having to rethink the way that the reordering of the world may also create some opportunities for countries which are further away from these fault lines, in terms of, you know, security realignment or access to energy. Or
I mean, I think that if there really is a decisive turn in Europe away from like Russian energy, that does have a set of consequences for Asian countries that have been moving closer to Russia energy wise, but particularly where gas is concerned, have been hitherto quite constrained by the pipeline issue, because there's only one pipeline that takes Russian gas eastward rather than westward, and that's the Power-Siberia pipeline to China that opened in 2019. And at the same time, although Russia does have a liquid natural gas capacity, probably a big expansion of it depends on further production in the Arctic in quite difficult fields and quite, you know, expensive fields. And in some sense, I think that Asian governments, Japan, China, and India, particularly, will be thinking about what their strategy in relation to that is. Do they now think that actually European governments won't have any choice but to back away, and that in some sense they can be the principal beneficiaries of what has happened, so long as their companies are willing to put up the finance and technology to help the Russians? Then there's the question of, well, would there be a significant American reaction against that? And that might yet still be unknown. And I would say the United States' own position complicates this further. Going back to a point you made earlier, you know, Vera, is that the United States since the 70s is moved around between different levels of foreign energy dependency. It's not ever got to the point of being largely energy independent again, but it did where gas was concerned, and its oil dependency, foreign oil dependency as a result of the shale boom, was much reduced. But the United States shale sector has not really recovered fully from the pandemic. It's not clear where oil in particular is concerned that it can. Already, Biden is back to asking OPEC Plus to produce more, but that involves really asking the Saudis to break with the Russians, which I don't think there's any evidence that they look like they're going to do. He's opened the strategic petroleum reserve the United States has, and planning over the next 6 months a bigger selling of oil from that than has ever been done before, and is trying to, you know, encourage greater exports from Canada. So the United States, I think, is moving back in the 2020s. I think are not going to be like the 2010s for the United States, where oil in particular is concerned, and that's before we even get onto the energy transition issue. But American choices, I think, were already getting harder again as a result of what happened to shale during the pandemic, even before we get onto the invasion and the energy shock that Russia has administered really to the entire world economy as a result of what it has done. So I would say that we're already beginning to see that the disorder of the 2020s on the energy side isn't quite going to be like the disorder of the the 2010s, because I think another shift in the American position is underway.
Wow. Thank you so much for these very, very comprehensive answers and for thinking along. There are many things that that are not quite in the book and that I can see you're thinking forward through. So I look forward to reading more of your writings on this. Disorder is out with Oxford University Press. Easy
That's
to get.
Correct, yeah.
Easy to read. Immensely rewarding. In its complexity and detail. Helen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Vera, and I like the chance that you gave me to think about some new things as well.
Lovely to have you, and looking forward to having you again on RevDem Podcast. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.